Hello and welcome to the OT Schoolhouse Podcast, your source for school-based occupational therapy tips, interviews, and professional development. Now, to get the conversation started, here is your host, Jason Davies. Class is officially in session.
Hello and welcome to another amazing episode of the OT Schoolhouse Podcast. So excited for you to be here today. And before we dive into the content for today and introducing our wonderful two guests that we have talking today about an amazing topic that if you've read the title of this episode, you are probably salivating because you are ready to learn all about the co-op model. I know I'm ready to share it with you. Seriously, this was one of the best episodes I've recorded in a long time, and I'm really excited for you to hear about it. But before I do that, I want to give a special shout out. You know, you don't get to 100 episodes or 102, 103 now without a little bit of help. And so I want to give actually a special shout out to my brother-in-law. His name is James. We call him Chemo, but he's my brother-in-law. He is my wife's brother, and he has been editing the OT Schoolhouse podcast episodes for some time now. And I just thought you should know that. You know, I know some people reach out to me and they're like, "Hey, Jason, I don't know how you do this all on your own." And the truth is, I don't do it all on my own. I have help. And so a special shout out to Chemo for holding down the episodes, editing them, putting them all together so that we can share them with you and so that you can learn about school-based occupational therapy every other week. And so I really appreciate it. Thank you so much, Chemo, for putting this in. You're probably blushing as you edit this right now. You better not cut it out. But yeah, thank you so much, Chemo. All right. With that, I want to go ahead and actually introduce our two speakers. A lot of times I let them introduce themselves, but these two speakers deserve a little bit of an introduction. And so I'm going to start with Dr. Helen Politajko. I'm sorry, Helen, if I butcher that. I really tried. It is a hard name to pronounce. But, you know, Dr. Politajko She's an occupational therapist from up north in Canada, and she has done amazing things. It wasn't till about 5 minutes before I jumped on the episode to record this that I also realized that she is actually the brilliant mind behind the Canadian Occupational Performance Measure, the COPM. Yeah, you know, it's not every day you get to hop on a call with the creator of the COPM. And it's not just within the field of occupational therapy that she is known for her brilliant contributions. She was actually appointed as an officer of the Order of Canada in 2021, and she is also a fellow of the Canadian Academy of Health Sciences. In addition to the COPM, Helen also developed the co-op approach. The co-op approach stands for Cognitive Orientation to Daily Occupational Performance. And that's what we're here to talk about today, the co-op approach and how that applies to school-based occupational therapy. So let me introduce our second guest on today, Dr. Lara Barros. And Lara actually was an understudy, if you could call it that, of Helen. She completed her OTD with the support of Helen. Now, Helen lives in Canada and Lara lives in Chicago. We're going to talk a little bit about that and how they got connected down the road. But now they have worked together and Lara has actually put out a guide to using the principles from the co-op approach within school-based occupational therapy. So that's what we're going to talk about today, a little bit about the development of the co-op approach and then how it applies to school-based occupational therapy with both Helen and Lara. If you're listening to this and you've already registered for the Back to School Conference in 2022, you might have seen Lara's name on the list of speakers. Lara is going to be talking at the actual conference, going more in depth about the co-op approach within schools, but we're going to talk a little bit about it today. If you're interested in the Back to School Conference and you're listening to this before August 26, 2022, head on over to otschoolhouse.com/conference to get registered now, or at least learn a little bit more about the conference. So without any further ado, I'm going to bring on Helen and bring on Lara, and we're going to talk all about the co-op approach. So go ahead, get comfortable, or if you're driving, keep your eyes on the road and just listen. And while you do that, I'm going to transition us into our interview with Dr. Barros and Dr. Politajko. Hello, Dr. Politajko and Dr. Barros. How are you doing today? I will go ahead and let's start with Dr. Barros. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Anything special going on today?
Not really. Not here. Mardi Gras, I suppose, right?
Yep. We are recording this on, today is March 1st, right?
March 1st, yeah.
Yeah. Happy March, everyone. And what about you, Dr. Paula Tycho? How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
All right. Did I say it right? Paula Tycho.
Almost. Paula, as in Paula, you know, and then Tycho.
Tycho. Oh, right. Thank you so much. Names are difficult. You know, we try our best, but names are difficult. So thank you both so much for being here today. And, you know, rather than asking you how you all got started and found yourself in occupational therapy, I actually want to start with a different question. And that is, what is one of your most fondest memories of being an occupational therapist? And Laura, would you like to go ahead and start?
Sure. Why not? I would have to say that one of my most favorite memories of being an OT was when I was doing my OTD. I had just finished a course where we had to kind of try to create like our own kind of guideline, right? So I had created this with a partner, this thing about a kind of a self-monitoring thing for the classroom and all this stuff. And then the next semester, I took a course where we went back to the theories, you know, the models that are, that, you know, are the foundations for OT. And mm-hmm. I turned the page and I found the cognitive orientation to daily occupational performance, the co-op approach. And I was like, I just can remember like reading the description over and over again, thinking like, how, you know, anyway, just thinking like I had found gold, right? So something that like, I guess the kid, you know, younger people today say, I felt very seen when I started reading that. So,
well, that's awesome. I'm hoping that when we, as we go through our conversations today, I'm hoping that there's many people that are listening that will feel the same way, because we are here to talk about the co-op approach. And so that is awesome. Now, I have to share a little story before Helen, I ask what's your most fondest memory is, because I was, you know, we were scheduling this podcast and I had no idea that I was about to jump on a call with the creator of the COPM, the co-op model, and you have just done so much for our profession. So first, I want to say thank you. And also, like I said, give you that opportunity. If you had to pick one thing, what's kind of your most fondest memory as an occupational therapist?
I don't know if it's a memory. I guess it's a memory, but it's certainly a moment. My most favorite moment, and it has to do with the words that Lara just used, which is about being seen, is when I was a young therapist, my first job ever, I worked on what was then called a back ward, where the children that nobody has any hope for are placed and basically forgotten about. And one of the children on that ward was this little boy named Sinchi. His real name was Jesus, but I guess because it's a very Christian environment, people decided not to call him Jesus. So they called him Sinchi. And Sinchi was a little boy. He had cognitive delay, of course. Very slight CP, very few words, the most amazing smile. And every morning when I came to work, as I opened the door to come onto the unit, he would run across the corridor, jump into my arms and kiss me hello.
Oh,
that is my OT moment of all time.
That is awesome. You know, it's amazing that, you know, no matter how much you create in this world, no matter what books you write, journals you write, podcasts you create, it's those memories that stick with us a lot of times. The ones that kid that we touched their life in some way. So thank you for sharing that. I really appreciate that. So I just mentioned before you answered that question that you're the creator of the COPM. However, Dr. Barros, Lara over here, she is not in Canada. So how did you two come to work together?
Well, if you want me, I'll go first.
Sorry, it's open-ended.
From my perspective, how we got together was Lara sent me an email saying, can I talk to you? And I said, sure.
Yeah, and Lara, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically it. I had taken the introduction course and I reached out to one of my instructors and was like, you know, I'm trying to use this in the school. I want to make sure I'm doing it with fidelity, right? I want to make sure I'm doing it well. And then probably within, what, like an hour? We were connected. So it was amazing. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. You know, and
I'm in Chicago. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm in Chicago. Helen was in Toronto at the time.
Right.
And I was in school at NYU online. So who knew?
And it was in the depths of COVID. So everybody was on Zoom anyway. So it didn't really matter who was where.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I love about podcasting, YouTube. The internet has made the world just much smaller these days, and it's quite amazing. And, you know, that story also just shows that, you know, never be worried about sending an email, a cold email out to someone. You never know what that person's going to respond. I mean, yeah, some emails get lost, but no one looks at an email and like purposefully says, no, forget that person. I'm not going to respond or anything, at least not very often. And for the most part, OTs are very kind and we're open to receiving emails and getting back. And especially when it comes to working on an OTD project about something that you've created, I would imagine that you're very eager to help people when it comes to the co-op approach. How many other, I'm sure you've had other OTD students and whatnot that you've worked with. Anything stick out as far as a specific program that you helped develop that was really great?
So not a lot of OTD students because there are no OTDs in Canada. It doesn't exist.
That's right.
But lots of PhD students who've done various pieces of work around co-op. You know, one that comes to mind was a woman by the name of Sarah McEwen, who was a physio with 15 years experience in stroke. And she was working as my research assistant. And she kept looking at this stuff and she's saying, you know, this should work with stroke. This should work with stroke. I think this should work with stroke. So we ended up doing a stroke study and looked at co-op and stroke. And she and we've done a number of others since. And then one time I got an email. I had done a co-op workshop in London, England, and I got an email from one of the participants who said, you know, I work with kids, young adults, sort of teenagers, young mm-hmm. people, with severe dystonia. And, you know, co-op seems to work with all kinds of kids, and there's nobody knows what to do with people with severe dystonia. Could we please try co-op? And that's generally how it happens. Somebody sends me an email or asks me a question, or I do a workshop and somebody in the audience says, what about? And because my dedication is always to research, my answer to what about is always, well, we either have data, or if we don't have data, are you interested in doing the research?
That's a good way to look at it. That's a great way to look at it. Let's get some data. Awesome. Well, yeah, we are here to talk about the co-op, the cognitive orientation to daily occupational performance approach. So I want to dive right into that. For many people listening, this might be the first time they've ever heard those six or so words put together. They might have heard co-op, but not necessarily know what it exactly means. So Helen, I want to give you the chance to actually just share kind of your elevator pitch for co-op. When someone asks you, what is co-op? How do you respond?
Well, first I want to talk about the word daily in there because it's cognitive orientation to occupational performance was the original name. And I work a lot with colleagues who are not OTs and they know I work in pediatrics and they say, well, really, you're doing occupation with children. That seems a bit odd. Like, aren't there laws against that? and so I said, well, I'm talking about the stuff they do every day and how does the word daily in front of the word occupation work? And everybody was happy. So that's why it's daily occupational performance. and it is daily occupational performance, but because it's all about figuring out what we can do to help people do the occupations that are important to them to do. And it's a top-down approach, and it uses their own cognitive strengths, their own abilities, to identify strategies that help them be able to accomplish the tasks, the goals that they want to accomplish.
Gotcha. And it sounds very occupational therapy. So I love that. And going a little bit further, and you can answer this question as well, is how did the co-op really come to be into existence? What drew you to creating this model?
So I'm a researcher and I'm a clinician. I'm a researcher. And I had my PhD was in the area of sensory integration. Very excited about it because it was such a hot, exciting topic at the time. And my early research after my PhD was all on interventions that therapists were using because mostly people do them and there's not a lot of data. And I'm very, very married or dedicated to getting data. So I started doing a whole bunch of research studies. And the joke in my lab kept being that my p-value was larger than my t or my f. And if you're not a stats person, it means that there is no result. Like basically, it makes no difference. So after doing research for several years where everything I did made no difference, clinicians were starting to not want to work with me because I just kept showing that what they're doing doesn't work. And so out of frustration, I decided that, you know what, we're going to stop looking at helping. And I was always in pediatrics. We're going to stop looking at helping children do better by using these sort of various sensory motor, neurodevelopmental approaches. And we're going to do what I used to do with Cinchy, you know, the little boy. When I worked with Cinchy, we were a behavioral unit. We used behavioral principles. And I was frustrated because I know I can take a child with an IQ of about 20 and teach him skills. I can do that using a behavioral approach very simply. It's hard work and it's long work, but it's not hard to do. Not as in intellectually hard to do. And now I can't take a kid with a DCD or a clumsiness who's got an IQ of 120 and I can't teach him how to write his name. That just doesn't make sense to me. So I decided to abandon all of those things and go to a behavioral approach. But because we were talking about kids with, you know, normal or better IQs, I didn't want a straight behavioral approach. I wanted a cognitive behavioral approach. So that's how we got to co-op.
I want to ask you to actually go a little bit further on that, cognitive approach versus behavioral approach. How do you kind of delineate the two?
So a cognitive approach, a behavioral approach, you know, is all about observable behavior, stimulus and response. So you do something, you do a response, I reinforce it, it increases the likelihood of occurrence. And if you do, if you don't do it, I don't reinforce you and it decreases the likelihood of reoccurrence. Cognitive behaviorism arose some years ago, many years ago now, because what they started to notice is that when you were doing these studies, if you told the subject, and these are intellectually normal people, if you told the subject what the reinforcement schedule was, and you know the research on what reinforcement schedules do and what kind of behavior they create and how that behavior works, whether it's a scallop effect or a step effect or what have you, that research is well established. It's very clear. So what they did was they would tell people what the reinforcement schedule was, and then they would actually implement a different reinforcement schedule than the one they told them. But the behaviors that emerged were consistent with the reinforcement schedule they were told, not the actual reinforcement schedule, which made it seem, and that's the case, is that the cognition, the thoughts, the thinking was actually controlling behavior much more so than the actual reinforcement schedule.
Oh, interesting.
And basically, that's kind of the birth of cognitive behaviorism. So now what we do is we use ideas to help you through whatever you have to do. And that's what co-op is all about. It's all about cognitive strategies used to help you perform.
Wow. Thank you. That was a really good explanation. I appreciate you taking that and just going with it. That was great. Now, you mentioned how you kind of started with children and developing the co-op approach. Was that simply because at the time you were working with children, or was there a specific reason that you decided to go that route?
Well, as I said, my PhD had been on sensory integration, and I had been working with kids with learning disabilities. And so the kids we were working with were all kids with learning disabilities. And as I said, I was getting very frustrated because we weren't having any effects on their outcomes. So we tried to identify an approach that would work with kids. So we used cognitive behaviorism, drew a lot of work from Donald Meichenbaum. I don't know if you're familiar with that gentleman's stuff, but he does a lot of cognitive behaviorism using problem-solving techniques. So we decided, you know what? These are bright kids. They know how to problem solve. We can use their skills as problem solver to help them solve these problems, their performance problems. So if you can't write your name, what is that about? And let's solve that performance problem. So that's how we started. And that was my population. All of my research had been in the area of DCD. So that's how we ended up working with kids.
Great. Well, thank you. Now, I want to kind of switch gears just a little bit and go back to Lara here, because like you both mentioned earlier, it started with an email, a simple email to Helen about wanting to do an OTD project about co-op. How did that turn into this project that you have where you created guidelines for school-based OT? Lara?
Well, Helen would probably say it was hours and hours of trying to figure out what I could do and what I could actually do because the research was there, right? Because I originally clicked with co-op because of I see so many children with kind of regulation, emotional and regulation issues, and they can do everything, but they couldn't do anything, right? You know, they have everything, but they can't perform. So after a lot of thinking, I really thought that, you know, I created this guideline because I wanted to be clear too. It's not the co-op approach that this guideline is. It's the using the principles of co-op, right? So you, if in order to learn the co-op approach, you need to take a course, there are books, it's more in depth than my thing. It's more about using these principles to become evidence-based in the schools. And I, you know, I'm a school-based therapist. I've been a school-based therapist for 20 some years. And, you know, always, you know, therapists are always hearing, oh, like, you need to push in, you need to do this, or you need to be evidence-based. And what I found is that, you know, really great therapists I work with resisted pushing in because they felt like an assistant, right? They felt like they were being a paraprofessional and they didn't know how to push in, right? How to be in the classroom and feel like a therapist. And I also saw so many people still tied to these performance component, you know, like not a bottom-up approach versus a top-down approach. So I wrote this kind of as a way for therapists to hopefully have at least one way to see that they can be evidence-based in the school, right? You know, because I think there's in one way to do it, right? I mean,
yeah.
I would like to say the best way, but there, you know, that there is a way to be evidence-based in the school.
Great. And you use that term.
You have to completely change how you're thinking, right?
You got to completely change how you're thinking to be evidence-based?
Yes. Yes. Because, not to be evidence-based, you have to change what you're doing, right? Because did you want to say something?
No, you finished. And I was going to add something to that.
Okay. Yeah. Because I think what you'll see, and I did read research from this, like therapists would say, oh, I want to push in, I want to do this, but it interferes with my ability to do these performance component, like, you know, playing games with like fine motor games or doing these visual motor or visual perceptual tasks. How do I do that in the classroom? So they're kind of this disconnect of what it means to be evidence-based. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. And Helen, I think Helen wanted to add on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think in terms of the being evidence-based, this is sort of back to, you know, why did we even start with co-op at all? Why did we create it? Being evidence-based, the evidence right now, and it's been there for some years, the evidence right now in terms of pediatrics is that a top-down, task-specific, task-oriented approach, that's what the evidence supports. The other approaches that have been around forevermore that are very bottom up. So, you know, improving your visual perception, improving your midline crossing, improving your grip, improving your bilateral coordination, all of those approaches that do that one way or another, they don't have the results. They just don't have them. The evidence doesn't support their use. So if you want to be evidence-based, you have to go to top-down approaches, because the other approaches just don't have the evidence behind them. Now, once you go to top-down approaches, then how do you actually do that? And that's, I think, where, you know, people like Lara start thinking, so how do you do that? And that's where, if you don't know what you're doing with that, it does feel like you're just, you know, sitting beside the student like the way a teaching assistant would, because you don't know what you're doing. But if you do know what you're doing, then a top-down approach makes a lot of sense. And in particular, if you do a co-op approach from a top-down perspective, it makes a lot of sense. And I just want to add it to that, like, because Lara didn't say it, but I thought he might actually. So how do we get from where Lara wanted to be, which was looking at self-regulation, and how could we use co-op for self-regulation in the school system, to using the principles of co-op to help create guidelines for school-based practice, was through a process called guided discovery. Like, I don't know if Lara realized that that's what I was doing with her.
not obviously in the moment, but yes, afterwards I'm like, oh, perfect. It was perfect. Yes. Yes.
So we're guiding her discovery. She says, I want to do self-regulation. So I want to do this. And then we start asking questions about it. Before you know it, it's, oh, I guess we should do these guidelines. It wasn't my idea. It was her idea.
That's perfect. Yeah, because, you know, I'm a master's thesis advisor, so I have 4 students at a local university that I work with. And yeah, it's kind of the same thing. You know, they come to me wanting to know what I want them to do. And that's not exactly how research works. We have to look at the literature that's already out there and find those gaps and then kind of move from there. We can't just kind of say, hey, I want to go after this. We need to figure out what's actually out there already.
I have to say you're lucky. If you students come to you saying, what do you want me to do? That'd be great. Most students come to me and say, I want to do this. Can you help me? That's usually how it works. That's how I work with Lara, too.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, they do kind of come and say, I want to do this. But I have to re-guide them, kind of what you're talking about a little bit, I think, to look at what's already out there. Because they might want to be doing something and then they realize, oh, that's already out there. Or, you know, they can't find any research on it. Well, why do you think that might be? One thing that I am a little not judgmental about, but you know, if you read an article, the conclusions are typically going to be this works. We don't often read articles that say this, or okay, maybe not this works, but we think this is going to work. We need to continue doing evidence. But we don't read articles, probably because they're not really published, that say this didn't work. And that's because they're not getting published necessarily. And so, you know, there's a lot to look at an article, read, and take away from it, and also what you don't get.
My PhD dissertation was a this did not work result. And it was initially very hard. It had to do with OT stuff. And it was initially very hard, in fact, impossible to get it published in OT. But I did get it published in Developmental Medicine and Child Neurology, which is, you know, a better journal anyway. But it's hard to get negative data published, for sure.
Yeah, I bet. And I mean, no one, again, we want to read something to learn what we can do, not necessarily to learn what isn't going to work. So, yeah. All right. So we've kind of already dipped into this, but Lara, if you had to say you had one, two main goals for your capstone project, putting these guidelines together, what would you say those were?
I would say something that was like action oriented, not just like thinking, like something that was actually, I feel like I'm in the point where I'm like, I don't want to hear about what I'm supposed to do, but like, how do I do it? Right. And like, And also seeing people around me struggle with that. Like, how do I do this? That would be the first one. And then obviously, I mean, like I said this before, when I found co-op, it was just connected to where my brain was. You know, when we go into some of the principles, we can talk more about, you know, just wanting to have the child's voice in it so much more, but also having it be more than an instinct, but have it be like real that, you know, this really does happen. I think that was it. That child centered, and this, you know, just a way to collect evidence as well, you know, to collect your own evidence. Like, I think as OTs, we're always asked to collect data, and you're taking data on stuff, and you're like, you know, I don't know what this data I'm taking is not particularly useful to anything or anybody. So I think the other thing was, is that using co-op and using the PQRS, which is part of the process, is you can collect your own evidence. Like you said about reading articles, you know, even if you find an article that's like, oh my gosh, it's so close to what I want to do, it's this, there's always something that makes it not be completely applicable to your population. Or, and no matter what, you have a kid in front of you who's not like that person in that study. So you know, collecting your own evidence is so important.
Absolutely. And I want to move on, but I also want to stay on that with collecting your own evidence. What do you do within your practice to collect that evidence? Are you writing in your daily notes a little, you know, 2 out of 3 attempts were complete or whatever it might be? Are you using some sort of computer program, or what does collecting data for your own evidence look like for you?
Well, I think that's probably jumping a little bit ahead, just because I think we should talk about the co-op approach being like starting from the goal, right? Does that make sense,
Helen? Perfect. Yeah. Well? I tend to get ahead of myself sometimes. So yeah. Yes, we will get there.
So I don't know. Are we at the part where I can just go ahead and say like, so it's a top-down approach, right? Co-op. And so you start with the goal. You don't like, rather than going and like testing, oh, you don't do like the VMI. You don't do like, oh, let me check out the classroom. You don't do all those things ahead of time. You say, you have a conversation. It can be the COPM, right? And you could say, hey, what do you want to do, right, with a kid? And sometimes in the school as well, we don't, the goals don't always come from a student, right? A lot of times the goals come from a teacher, mm-hmm. something that the kid has to do, right, or is expected to do. And so, but always finding the time to kind of, to translate into something that the child has decided. Does that, you know, so, yeah. So maybe the teacher's like, oh, they need to write like this much. Well, then you talk, you know, there's this conversation that goes on. If you had to write this much, like how, you know, what would you want to write about? You know, whatever, however you get to the child's goal, you have to start with a goal from a child.
Awesome. Yeah. I completely love that. It's, I always tell people that the first thing we really need to do is develop that occupational profile, right? We always have to start with the occupational profile. And part of that is realizing or understanding why the child's even being referred to us. You know, there needs to be kind of that overarching, what are we looking for? You shouldn't just get, at least in my opinion, the teacher shouldn't just say, hey, I need an OT referral for Johnny. And then we just go look at Johnny. Like, what are we looking for? We need to know what the concern is, what the goal is, like you just mentioned. So absolutely. We're going to continue that, but I want to go one thing backwards, one step, because in the guidelines that you have, you pointed out three very particular participants. And two of those, I think, makes complete sense. You have the occupational therapist, ourselves. You have the student. Obviously, we work with the student. But then you also mention a support adult. What do you mean by the support adult?
Okay. And that is part of the co-op approach, right? So it's not something unique. I didn't make that up. But the supportive adult is really the person who, first of all, they're your go-to person, right? Like in general, right? This is somebody who has to be able to see the kid do what their goal is, right? And so this person is going to be your ally. They will be the person who helps with the generalization and transfer and also kind of actually report what it looks like when you're not there, right? And so they can help, you can actually teach the adult, this supportive adult, how to do guided discovery, because I think what we see in schools from OTs, teachers, everybody wants to see a kid be successful, right? And so we go in there and we sharpen their pencil just right. We tilt their paper. So teaching this person what guided discovery is all about and what you're doing, leaving a plan. I mean, I think it'll all make sense later, but they'll be the person that is the one who can report back to you. Does that make sense? And it could be the teacher. It could be the, in the schools, it should be someone in the school. And you can also have the adult, the parent or the guardian at home.
Yeah.
So if I can add, co-op has four basic goals for any intervention. They're the same goals for all people. For all our clients, the first goal is the person's goal. So whatever that person wants to do in co-op, we usually ask for three goals for lots of reasons we can talk about theoretically if you like, but we usually ask for three goals. But it's got to be, so the first thing is goal attainment. So whatever that goal is, riding your bike, writing your name, playing Nintendo, catching a soccer ball, kicking a soccer ball, whatever your goal happens to be. So that's always the first goal that we have within co-op, is that we achieve the goal that the client wants. The second goal we have in co-op is that the client learns strategy use. They learn to use a problem-solving strategy, which is a metacognitive strategy, and they also learn to use domain-specific strategies. We can talk about all of those things if you like. The third goal is generalization, and the fourth goal is transfer. Generalization and transfer is about the child or the client being able to do the thing that they're learning with you in OTE out there. And then transfer is about the client learning how to do the thing they learned with you in OT and then related skills or different skills. So I know when I was a therapist, when I was a practicing clinician, and a teacher would tell me, that kid has real trouble focusing or real trouble, using a pencil or stuff. And I used to be really, really proud, because when I worked with the kid in my sessions, he was fine. In my sessions, he paid attention the whole time. Like, I had an hour session and he was with me for the full hour. I don't know what's wrong with that teacher, because he can't keep his attention, right? So that's about generalization. That's about, if I can manage your attention for an hour, what can I do so that you can take that ability to attend into the classroom? And mostly we don't worry about generalization, but in co-op, it's a major, major focus. Taking the skill, whatever that skill happens to be, into the place it needs to be in the real world. And then building on that skill. So generalization, transfer.
That's great. I really like that, because kids don't go to school to get therapy. They go to school to be in education. And so if what we're doing is only helping them in the OT room, then we are not necessarily meeting the goal for that student when it needs to be done in the educational setting, right? So perfect. You mentioned some problem solving. And I know, Lara, you've had several different pieces of the puzzle when it comes to your guidelines. And a few of those guidelines really revolved around problem solving. So I just want to let you elaborate on those principles a little bit more.
Yeah. So really, co-op is problem solving, right? So you have this goal, you try to get the kid as specific as possible, right? So recently, let's say I have a girl who wants to cut paper. She has to cut every, her spelling words out, right? She wants to cut it, but she's really bothered by the sound of the paper, right? So cutting for some reason, right? So this is something that she's identified. So she wants to be able to cut neatly, whatever. So get it as close as possible, right? The goal is as specific as possible. And then to actually observe the actual performance, right? So sometimes in the school, you might have to have someone record it because you're not there exactly when it's happening, right? So if possible, you can to do that. And then, or, you know, anyway, so you want to observe the actual performance. So that's part of, that's the first thing. That's the dynamic performance analysis, right? So you're watching it and you're kind of, you're recording. And this is where the PQR, the first PQRS comes into, right? This, the performance quality rating scale. So then based on what their goal is, you watch their performance and then you determine on a scale from 1 to 10 how close they are. You know, where is their performance at on this on this self-identified goal, right? And then what you do is then you identify the breakdowns, right? So you're not saying like, "Oh, they're too weak, they can't do this." You're saying, "Oh, she cuts off the line." Right. You do whatever, just observable behavior that you can see versus trying to think back and like try to sound like technical, which I think as OTs, I think sometimes when we don't know what to do, we try to sound more technical. Right. And so I think it was kind of a relief too. So you might say, "Oh, she drops the scissors," right? She stops and she shakes her hands a lot. Like something, what are you seeing that's interfering with her being able to do this. So that's the first thing, right? You watch this performance. And then like Helen just talked about guide discovery, which she so cleverly did on me before I was very good on it, is the process of helping the child. First, you want the child to kind of identify their own, discover their own breakdowns, right? So helping them kind of see whether or not, see what's happening. Do you know, kind of was, did it work or not? And, you know, let's see why, what do you think might have gotten in the way, kind of a thing. And then helping guide them to their own strategies, right? So let's say if someone's, I think Helen always gives the example, which is a pretty good example for kids, right? Is the like, you know, so many kids try to write and their paper's moving, right? Like they're not holding their hands not down, their paper's moving, they're writing. So just doing things super, like helping guide them. And then like, I guess I'm jumping ahead. That's a bit of an enabling principle, right? So you're kind of showing them however they need to see so that they can be going, "Oh, wait a second, my hand needs to," you know? So you're trying to doing what you do best as an OT that you typically would have done on your own, guiding them to figure out on them by themselves.
I love that.
I know Helen can probably say it a lot clearer than that, but
so the example of the paper moving thing is one of the first kids we worked with, and we're working with the child and we're working on handwriting and the kid's writing. And of course he's not stabilizing his paper because they don't, many DCD kids don't, he's not stabilizing the paper. And so from a guided discovery perspective, as a therapist, I realized that he needs to stabilize his paper. So, but from a guided discovery perspective, I say, "Huh, that's really interesting." And the kid kind of goes, "What's interesting?" And you go, "Well, I don't know. Like, I wonder if that happens when I write." And the kid's like, What are you talking about? And you go, "Well, when you write, the paper moves." And the kid goes, "Oh, really? Yeah. Does my paper move when I write?" And the kid goes, "I don't know." So then you write.
Yeah.
And of course, you very, very blatantly slap your hand down on top of the piece of paper so that it doesn't move. And the kid says, "No, your paper doesn't move." And then the next question is, "Does that matter? Like, does it matter if your paper moves or doesn't move when you write?" Right. And then eventually the child discovers that he needs to stabilize his paper and that he has a helper hand to do that with. And then the homework becomes, so this helper hand, and this is a true, all my stories are always true, by the way, I don't make them up. And so this kid, his homework was to go home and find five other things that you can use your helper hand for and come back and tell me next time. This is the generalization transfer piece that we're talking about, right? Yeah. And so things like opening up a bag of popcorn or a bag of potato chips or, you know, buttoning my shirt, whatever. So five things. And then his next piece of homework was, and the other thing I want you to find out is, does everybody in your family have a helper hand? And you know what happened? He came back and his brother didn't have one. And you know what? He wasn't going to tell him.
He wasn't going to tell his brother that he didn't have a helper hand.
No, and he wasn't going to tell his brother that there is a helper hand.
Oh.
About his brother.
He was going to let his brother struggle.
Figure it out on his own, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, so like with my sister.
DCD tends to run in families, right? There's a genetic component to DCD. And so if he's got DCD, somebody is likely to have DCD in that family. So when you send him home with the homework, it's likely that somebody's going to come back and not have a helper hand.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. Go ahead, and I was just going to say, like with my example with the scissors, she noticed that she really holds onto her scissors really hard. She really grips them really hard. So, and like one of the things about the school is we don't have 45 minutes, right, to work with a student. So we had to kind of leave it at there. We talked about, okay, that you hold your, I wonder if that's what's making cutting so hard, right? And not the exact words, but then also saying, okay, well, why don't you go over the next week and play around with like, what happens when you hold your scissors different ways? Or are there other things that you hold really hard that if you held them lighter, you could still actually hold them and it would work better. So that was this girl. We didn't get to like the final thing, right? But we're able to use what she discovered about her performance and have her work on it through the week. And actually, I was supposed to see her today, but she was absent. So I don't know how that worked out.
But, it's all right. It's all right. Next time, next week.
Yeah.
You know, I really like the conversation we're having right now, because I feel like there's a lot of occupational therapists out there, not just in the schools, but in general, that feel like if we're not hands-on, then we're not doing occupational therapy. And I'm sure you could both speak about this, and I'll give you that chance in a moment. But, you know, I'm thinking about a girl that I've worked with who, she got so frustrated. She was trying to, I think we were cutting. She got so frustrated, she just threw the paper and the scissors down on the table. You know, me trying to do hand over hand in that moment would have been pointless. But doing something like what you're talking about, you know, helping her to guide through what's going on and see where the trouble points are, I think would have done wonders. So, yeah, do you want to talk about that idea that if we're not doing, you know, hands-on therapy, that's still occupational therapy, Helen?
Sure. I want to say two things about that. One, in terms of the frustration piece, right? So from a guided discovery purpose, and this is why Lara said before, you know, we can talk about co-op, but it's not going to help you figure out how to actually do it. Because one of the things about guided discovery is being very careful about just the right challenge, right? Because you don't ever want to get the kid or the whatever client, because we keep saying kids, and I know this is about school, OT school, but co-op is not just for kids. You don't want to ever get the client to the point of frustration. Because from a behavioral perspective, then they're not going to want to do this ever again, right? So you want to be able to change the way you guide your discovery sufficiently that we never get to that point of frustration. And you want to be able to predict how that's going to happen. You also don't want to do the opposite. You also don't want to make it so simple that the child gets the sense of, well, this is like, you just made it so easy for me. Like, it doesn't really matter because like, you're really the one who's doing it. I'm not really doing it. So you want the child to have ownership of the solution. You want to have the child ownership of figuring out what's going wrong. And you want the child to have ownership of figuring out that this is working well. So that's one thing. The hands-on thing, and like, you know, I have to stabilize you, or I have to, you know, hand over hand or whatever. My comment about that, and therapists ask about that often in workshop, my comment about that, like if it requires you sort of stabilizing the child's hips, let's say, to do whatever, are you prepared to like be with that child 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? And if you are, great, then let's use stabilization. But if you're not, then you have to think of a different way to do it.
So real quick, I want to just push back just for the sake of conversation and talking it out. What about using some sort of an adapted chair or something, just going along with that? What would you say about that then?
I would say, and how many pieces of adaptive equipment sit in the back of people's cupboards? Right. Yes. So an example we have is, and this was an older, well, compared to kids, but young, 45-year-old gentleman post-stroke, about 3-4 years post-stroke, who had been a rider, who used to ride his bike all the time. And then during co-op, he decided that he'd like to learn how to ride his bike again. And one of the problems from a dynamic performance analysis perspective, one of the problems with his bike riding is that due to the stroke, he had lost all sensation in his right foot. So when he's riding his bike, when he tries to ride his bike, he has to stare down on his foot to guide the foot into onto the pedal and to keep it on the pedal because he needs to use visual guidance. He can't do it from the sensation of the foot. So if you suggested to him and somebody had that, you know, we could give you a bike and we could give you an adaptive bike. And he's, no, I don't want that. I don't want anything like that. But that gentleman, because he was into bike riding, happened to watch the Tour de France on the weekend. And all the professional bikers use toe clips. So no, he did not want an adapted bike, but he absolutely wanted those professional toe clips.
Yeah.
So off he goes to the store, buys the best possible toe clips, gets the mounted on his bike. And now all we need is some visual guidance to get his foot into the toe clip. And after that, he's home free.
Don't forget, you also need to get your foot out of the toe clips. Otherwise, it's not good.
Getting out, he was fine. But getting into this, yeah. Yeah.
Perfect. All right. That's great.
Adaptive equipment is only as good as if the person wants it. If the person wants the adaptive equipment, by all means. But if the person doesn't want it, what's the point?
Yeah. And I think we often, I mean, just as a whole, as OTs, or if you're in the schools, the IEP team, we often forget about that piece. You know, the kid is not sitting there often in our IEP with us. And we have to take into account how they might feel with whatever we're doing. Because especially when you get up into middle school and high school, those kids care so much about the perception that they receive from others. And, you know, we had a 16, 17-year-old with visual difficulties. And the last thing he wanted to do for his social image was sit in the front of the classroom. And so we had to come up with another way. Otherwise, you know, he would have sat in the front of the classroom and then totally disengaged. And so
from a guided discovery perspective, you shouldn't be saying we had to come up with a totally different way. You should be saying we had to help her or him come up with a totally different way. The way that they felt, that child felt, was important.
And that's what was key for me. And because we're sitting in this IEP and he's not there. And so that's what I'm talking about. We're trying to come up with an idea. And I had to bring that idea to the table, you know, that because I had had those types of conversations with him. And that's how I knew to let the team know, you know, he's not going to want to sit up there. We need to include him on this. So absolutely. This leads perfectly into, I think, the next question, which also, Laura, it's going to feed back into where you left off with the COPM with that student with the scissors, using the scissors and cutting. Where do you go from there? What type of service models fit best? I kind of think I already know the answer, but I want to let you establish a little bit more.
Well, this girl is actually just an RTI kid. So like a response to intervention, just somebody, she happened to, the teacher reached out because she had tried giving her, she's a fourth grader. She had, the girl had actually, it's kind of funny because it fit perfectly into this. She had, the girl identified three goals on her own, right? She she has a Y in her name, right? And she would reverse it. And then she also was having a hard time writing. When she would write a times, like for a math problem, like 4 times 3, it would turn out to be a plus. And so she was having a hard time writing that. So that, and then the cutting piece. So really this is an RTI kid. She came with her three goals. We didn't even really have to do much of an occupational performance or profile, right? She had them, and the teacher had already tried like the basic, like giving her handwriting. She'd already done what the teacher could do, right? She'd really tried. And so, I mean, RTI, it's perfect for RTI, which of course then means that it's perfect for direct service. It's perfect for pretty much everything. The only thing it's would be hard for, unless you record it for, is, you know, just a pure consultation where you're only talking to the teacher. It just requires more talking, right? Like, and more work on the back end where if you can actually, the best way is to actually be able to physically see the student. Is that.
Yeah. Yeah. So then collaboration is what often comes to mind, you know, getting into the classroom, potentially sitting close to the student. And I want to be careful because collaboration is, there's a difference between collaboration in the classroom versus, in my opinion, a push-in one-on-one where you're almost, I don't know, when I think of push-in one-on-one, I think more of that it's pulled out. It's just in the classroom. I'm going to be there as a support person, like you talked about earlier, versus a collaboration model, getting in there, making sure that we have all three people involved, yourself, the student, and the support person, likely the teacher or even a potentially an aide helping with the process. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So like what comes out of this dynamic performance analysis, obviously with the guided discovery and just helping the student come up with their breakdowns, is a plan, right? So this student creates a plan, and how are they, you know, okay, this is the, you know, like I guess with Helen, with her paper, right? It would be like, okay, she might not have had to do this, but like when I'm writing, I will put my hand down on the paper, right? It doesn't have to, I mean, so there's a plan that goes back to the teacher, right? So, and sometimes it's, or the support person. So that's like another piece of the collaboration. So even if you were to pull the kid out and work on this, you come back to the class with a plan. No matter where you stop, you come back with, this is where we're at. And this is what we're going to focus on. Like, just Monday, I think I have a little kindergartner who, he holds his pencil very high on the pencil. And so we did some, guided discovery, like, you know, where does it feel best? Like have his hand all over. And then I took a picture of where he said it felt best. Right. Again, we're still in the middle of this right now. And, the problem I'm having now is he's having a hard time understanding like how he would even get his pencil to look like the picture, right? He's not there yet, right? but we're in the process where we're starting this. It's not always like a 20-minute thing where they're like, oh, I do this and look, it's magically done. Sometimes, especially with this is a kindergartner and he's also a kid with some language challenges, like both English as a second language, as well as just me having a hard, he's got some articulation challenges where, so it's hard, like the communication can be a little bit challenging. So I guess I can't remember the question now. Go ahead.
We were going on and talking about the process you were going through. So, you know, you had identified the concern and now you were going through the guided discovery and then trying to figure out problem solutions and helping him to
helping him figure. Yeah. So basically what we were noticing is that, you know, this kid was having a hard time writing in between the lines. Right. And knowing that when you hold the pencil, the very end at the one side, that it's really hard to control. Like we just played around with like, could this help if you held it somewhere else? Could it help? And then, so he's still in the process. His homework was to play around with that, if it mattered where it was on his, where his hand was on the pencil.
Okay. Gotcha. Now let's go kind of full circle, because I started too soon with the data part, but now we've kind of walked through that process a little bit. So, and maybe a different example, it sounds like you're not quite there with this kiddo yet, but with another kiddo, what does it look like down the road a little bit when you get to that part to see if what you did actually worked?
Okay. So then the DPA is a continual, like iterative process, right? So you keep doing it. And then you come up with a plan and then you have the kid try it like in their real environment, right? And then kind of report back, hey, is your plan working? Yes or no? And then at that point, I would it depends on the kid and depends on when you can do it. Either get a teacher report back, right? That yes, this is working, or go in and observe or have somebody record it to see. And then you would score it based on that. And if it wasn't working, that'd be another time to go in and watch and say, what's going on? Maybe there's something that we didn't notice the first time that's happening. Or maybe, you know, a lot of times if you fix like one thing, other things will resolve, but not all the time. Right. Mm-hmm. So just always going in and looking and seeing the actual performance as much as possible. Right. So that you can, because otherwise you can't pull in that environment piece. Right. So maybe the kid next to him is, you know, is irritating him, or like you said, you know, anything that might impact performance, really.
Yeah. And I want to ask you a question. There's no right or wrong answer to this, I don't think. But when you take data, do you like to take data every single session? Do you like to do it once a month? Do you like to really maybe quarterly? What does that look like for you?
I think that depends on the student. I would say I'd like to take the data when we feel like when the kid feels like they have they're trying out a new performance. You know, they're ready to show me, then I'll do it with a PQRS. Yeah. But I think it depends on the kid. It depends. And it also depends on the actual task they're doing, right? Something like the girl who's making the X's and pluses, right? Like mixing them up. Like her, I did it like, we did it the first day. I mean, once she figured out how to fix her Y, we were like, oh, I wonder if that plan that you had to fix your Y, I wonder if that will work. That strategy will work to fix your X, right? Like that, right? And I just took data afterwards to double check and make sure it was sticking. Because otherwise, like we said, just because they can do it in your room, right? It does not mean that they can do it in math class. So,
some therapists like to. So this is what Laura's describing as the PQRS performance rating scale. So we, you know, how well is the child performing this now on a 10-point scale, and then at the end of your sessions or whatever again. But some therapists like, or for some kids, they like to do that PQRS with the child every day. Right. So how good was that X yesterday? Or you could do something like, so count how many X's did we make, and how many of them were the way we were perfect, the way you want them, and how many of them were not so perfect. So let's count how many perfect X's you did. I remember this one child we were working with handwriting, and the child was doing really badly, and the therapist was getting frustrated. The child was getting frustrated because there were just so many mistakes, like so many mistakes. Right. So I went back and I said, well, how many were good letters? Right? And then what we did was we kept track of how many good letters we did today. And what we kept track of was how many, not me, the therapist and the child. And then what we kept track of, we even graphed it because that kid liked that idea. So we even graphed how many good letters. So what percentage of all the letters you wrote are good letters, right? It just changes everything. And what makes this, and sometimes this A is a good A and this A is not a good A. So what's the difference between these two? What makes this a good A? Well, because it goes up higher, or it goes up lower, or the circle's rounder, and once you start talking with kids about these things, they know it. They can tell you. It's not like they have sensory perceptual deficits and they don't even know the difference between a good circle and a bad circle. They know the difference between a good circle and a bad circle. But you can get them to do their own data recording even. And then you've got it for your charts.
Yeah. I just keep thinking to myself that I love how there's that client-centered self-assessment piece to it. And that seems to be a really key point, valuable point to using the co-op approach. Go ahead, Laura.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and I know that just a kid today I have who was looking at his handwriting, right? And he was just you find out a lot about their self-efficacy, right? Their self-esteem, all this with it, because this kid was being terribly hard on himself, like Helen just said, but... And he hasn't been hard on himself in the past, right? So just kind of, I think it gives you, when they're self-assessing, it gives you a feel for where they're at and something else that maybe is a breakdown, right? Like something they need to work on with this. Like, how do we help him feel better about what he's doing? Because I mean, I would just say handwriting, the main purpose of handwriting is so someone else can read it, right? Well, if I can read it, then that's pretty good, you know?
Agreed.
So just kind of changing, I always try to too, like with the kids, help them understand the goal of what it is. Like, yes, you want to write neatly and everything, but why is it important to write neatly? Right? Absolutely. So someone else can read it, right?
Yeah. You know, handwriting is not in the the OT practice framework as an occupation. It is not a occupation on its own. Yes, it is very meaningful to many other occupations of, you know, learning, education, work, everything like that. But it is not an occupation itself. The whole point, like you just said, we need to be able, it's communication is what it really is. And so if you can communicate, then we're doing okay.
Well, and that's actually a huge, you can tell that's like something that sticks with me, because I do have this conversation with OTs all the time. It's like, who cares if they can handwrite, right? It doesn't, it's like the purpose is the written expression, right? It's really so that they can do this assignment. They can do this, you know, they can, I mean, I do love for a kid to be able to write their name, right? I think every parent wants their kid to write their name, but beyond that, other than like finding out what is important to the parents and family, like, you know, if they're supposed to, if handwriting is super laborious for them and they don't know what they're saying, like, why not see if maybe the kid might be interested, you know, in trying out like technology to see, especially since it's so available to so many students. So
Yeah. And you know, we are getting a little far along in the podcast, but I had a question that I really wanted to bring up. And I know, I know Helen was really interested in this topic because this is something that comes straight from the AOTA community, And it's about handwriting where we were just talking about. And someone anonymously posted and well, I'm just going to read it here. You know, they wrote that they found an AOTA document that stated, don't provide isolated training on the components of handwriting. And so their question was, is the research telling us not to use the interventions that address isolated component skills for handwriting at all? And what they cited here was actually a document that does come from AOTA that I don't know if it was the evidence practice type of stuff that they put out every occasionally, but there was a document and it said this. And so, Helen, what would you, what's your comments on this?
Well, we've already talked a little bit about the evidence for top down versus bottom up approaches, and teaching the components of handwriting is definitely bottom up. So I guess the question I would have for anybody who's listening is, let's imagine for a minute that you need hand strengthening, right? Because your hand fatigues when you write and you need hand strengthening. So we do lots of lovely little exercises on hand strengthening. And now you've got your hands really nice and strong, and you've got great independent digit movement, and you've got great grip, even a lovely pincer grip. You've got it all. Everything's really good. Go ahead and play the piano for me.
I can barely keyboard. I mean, like type. So yeah, that probably won't help me at all with keyboarding.
So the point being, those component skills might give you difficulty doing a task, but if you don't know how to do the task, doesn't matter how good your component skills are, you'll never be able to do the task. And by doing the task, you'll improve the component skills. So if you need to learn how to write, then let's work on handwriting. And by working on handwriting, you're also going to get better grip and better pencil grip and better strength and all of those kinds of things. The difference between co-op and other sort of handwriting programs, for example, or any direct skill training programs, is that the direct skill training works. We know that, right? The trouble with direct skill training is after the training is over, it often fades down. Like if you imagine the graph, so we didn't know how to do it, we're now doing it. And I know this is audio and nobody's watching my visuals that I'm doing. And
we have a downward right trend on a graph.
Yeah, you have a down. So usually, you know, the graph is going up because you're teaching the skill and now we have the skill and then therapy's over and it plummets again. The reason it plummets again is because the skill, the task-specific training doesn't maintain and it doesn't generalize and it doesn't transfer. The thing that helps it maintain, the things that helps it generalize and things that helps it transfer are one, motivation, right? If the child really wanted to learn how to ride his bike or learn how to ride his name, once he's got it, he's going to do it some more versus you decide that he's got to do strengthening of his hand. And then secondly, the activity in and of itself does that, right? Like we talk about therapeutic use of activity. Well, if y'all want to get a better grip, handwriting is a therapeutic use of activity, if you want to think about it that way. But the therapeutic use of activity does not become the skill, right? So it's not that it's a two-way street. It literally is a one-way street. And then, so now we have the skill. If the child wanted that skill in the first place, which is why we're client-centered, then he's going to use that skill outside of the therapy room. And if he's going to start using that skill, then it will increase the ability to, you know, use his fingers or whatever. I think you said, Jason, that you had watched the TED Talk with the girl on her bike riding. So one of the side effects of her improving her bike riding is she actually could get away with using her wheelchair a lot less. Because one of the things that bike riding does for you is it increases the strength in your legs. Mm-hmm. So now she didn't need to use her wheelchair hardly at all anymore.
Wow. That's awesome. And yeah, for anyone out there, I will be sure to link in the show notes to the TED Talk that Helen gave. When was that? How long ago was that TED Talk?
Oh, I don't know, maybe 3 years ago now.
Okay. So still pretty recent. Seems like forever ago, but that's not too long ago. All right. Yeah, I will link to that so you can all watch Helen share this story about a teenager who used the co-op, who they collaborated, the team collaborated, using the co-op approach to support this teenager in riding a bike, and super happy.
Yeah, a teenager who had wanted to learn how to ride her bike since she was 5 years old because her whole family was bikers. She lives in Ireland, actually. And she had, you know, in fact, she's given speeches on this stuff.
Oh, wow.
She'd done cord strengthening. She had done all of those kinds of things and still couldn't ride her bike. And even though her family, as I said, are bikers, and she'd been trying to learn how to ride a bike since she was 5, she was 15 at this time. And she learned how to ride a bike in 180 minutes. She became an independent bike rider in 180 minutes.
That is very fast. Very fast. Wow. Yeah, I was just watching, hoping that she knew how to use the brakes at some point. I was like, great, she's got the pedaling down.
This is a young woman with severe dystonia, such severe dystonia that she actually had to have a brain implant to try and control the dystonia.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So yeah, we will be sure to link to that so anyone can watch it. And, you know, TED Talks are nice and short and they're always fun to watch. So yes, we will be sure to link to that. All right. I want to wrap up, but I have one more question because I think this is important. In the guidelines, Laura, you kind of mentioned the importance of being in a supportive environment. And I just want to ask you a little bit about that. What should OTs kind of look for, but also how can they support a supportive environment? How can they create a supportive environment within their schools?
I'm trying to think like the best way to say this. Well, I think one thing is to really become a part of the environment, right? To become a part of the school. I know it can be hard if you're like right now I'm in 5 different schools, right? I've had the luxury of being able to be with some of them for years, but it is tricky. I would say the best way is to talk to people, right? I think the first thing is to, once you start collaborating, once you start asking the teachers, like what their goal is and what does that really need to look like? You start to build these relationships with them and then they start to understand more what you do. Cause I think for many teachers, and Jason, you might agree, and I'm sure you do, Helen, that like what OT does is a mystery. They're not sure what they do, what we do. And I think people who are administrators right now were mostly teachers in the heyday of working on performance component skills, right? The OT is the one who brings in these fabulous activities. They're so cute and they're so fun. But like, so just getting in there and kind of trying to change the perception of it. So I've, you know, what do I do? Like I've joined book clubs, right? I go in there a half an hour early a week and I join book clubs. And what I find as an OT is that these teachers that I work with are a lot more similar to me than I would have ever thought. Their wishes and their hopes for these kids are the same. And then I think really once you take the time to listen, right, and you take the time to show them, I guess the biggest thing I've noticed is as soon as you show a teacher that if you ask a student, hey, what do you think? How do you think you should do this, right? Even if you don't go through the whole co-op thing, right? If you just say like, hey, how do you think this works? And then they like you teach them how just to even ask the kid. Cause I think teachers feel this huge weight. And I think in OTs as well, feel this huge weight to be a problem solver. Like I have got to fix this for this kid, but sometimes it's like a 5-minute conversation with a kid and they know what they want to do. Right. Like, what if I do this? Okay, well, let's try it. Right. Like, so I think it's about relationships as always, as far as in being present as much as possible. Right. I know it's hard, but
yeah, I completely agree. And one thing that I like to say is the power of a quick win. And I think something like so many of the examples you've given today, that could be an easy, quick win that you do in front of the teacher and the teacher sees it. And that teacher is now knows what to do the next time she sees a student not holding the paper. Holding the pencil incorrectly. They know what question to ask or they know what little accommodation to use. And teachers love that so much. I sometimes joke that us as occupational therapists, we go and we sit in hour and a half, 2-hour, 3-hour long training sometimes. And when I go to conferences with my wife, their sessions are like 30 minutes long. I'm like, wait, how are you doing anything in 30 minutes long? But teachers are used to that. They're used to getting just what they need, not necessarily all the research behind it. And if we can give them exactly what they need, it helps us to develop a relationship with them, which again, that supports a supportive environment. So
yeah.
Well,
I can say one quick thing really. Is also tying it into something they're already doing, right? Like, so when I'm working with, you know, I mean, most of what we get handwriting and regulation, right? Those are our two biggest things. Like, oh, I can't get this kid to sit. So in my district that I'm in, they use the RULER program, which is out of Yale. They use this mood meter. So if I can, the more I can get them to understand that sensory in quotation marks, right, is no different than this mood meter here, right? Like it's, you know, like And bringing that cognitive piece into it, I think, like Helen said earlier, like the nothing magical is going to happen. So, like, I know a lot of teachers are doing go noodles, they're taking, you know, movement breaks. But hey, the reason why we're doing this is to bring the energy down in here so that the kids actually are, they start to understand why we're doing this stuff, not just like magically thinking it's going to happen. So that's another thing, is tying it into something that they're already doing.
Absolutely. Teachers don't want more work. They want less work. And if you can make it easier on them, they
nobody wants more
use it.
Work.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. Well, we have been talking for a long time. I don't know. Maybe this will even be split up into two episodes. I don't know. Once we edit it, we'll figure that out. But it's obviously not long enough for someone who really wants to understand co-op. We talked about a lot, but as I think, Laura, you said earlier, you know, you really need to actually go through the training if you really want to understand this. And so with that, where should people who are interested in taking that next step, where should they go? Where can they learn more?
The thing about the co-op approach is we're researchers and clinicians, and we care about people doing better. We're not marketers, and we're not great business people. So if you want to learn about the co-op approach, there is a free half-hour video that through the University of Toronto that you can go look at anytime. It's free for anybody who wants to go look at it. Through the University of Toronto, the Occupational Therapy Continuing Education tab, I think. Other than that, you can take a co-op course. There is an online course, again, through the University of Toronto that you can take. But mostly what happens is people organize training courses. And we don't organize them or anything, but people invite us to come and set up training courses. We have over 50 instructors, co-op instructors around the world. And we do training courses in the various languages. So, you know, in Hebrew and in French and in Italian and Dutch and Swedish and whatever. So basically, you can go to the website, you can find out, you know, who are the OTs in your neighborhood, or you can invite me and Laura. I'm sure Laura would be happy to come and set up a course, and we'll teach you how to do co-op.
Awesome. And I'm looking at the website. I believe it's the icancoop.com. .org. So that's an area to at least get started with learning a lot more about what Helen just said. And who knows, maybe we'll organize specifically something for the OT Schoolhouse. That'd be fun too. So maybe we can even work something on the next step. Laura, would you like to say anything else about what to do? What would be the next step for a school-based OT?
I would say what I've told my friends, right, is just start by you know, asking a kid what they want to work on. What is their goal? So starting there, and then just wait for what happens after that. Once you start including the kids more, then I mean, you'll be hooked, to be honest. So awesome. Do that. And obviously top down, right? Like let go of your bags, let go of your hours of treatment planning, and just go in and be with the kids where they're at.
That sounds like the perfect sentence to end this podcast on. Thank you so much for sharing. I really appreciate you both being here. Helen, I see your finger up. Go for it.
Yeah. I just wanted to end the podcast with a slightly different end. And that is, co-op, we said, is a problem-solving approach. The metacognitive strategy that's used in co-op is goal, plan, do, check. What's my goal? Your goal today was to have a podcast. What was your plan?
I put questions together, and I was going to ask you questions.
You put questions together. You invited us. And did we do it?
We did.
And check, are you done? Are you happy?
I am not done. I've got to edit it. I've got to... I still got a lot to do, but I am happy with how this conversation turned out. So excellent.
Right. So your plan is multi-step, and we've only done a few of the steps.
Absolutely.
So we've got a way to go. So go plan, do check, away you go.
Oh my God.
Sounds good.
The first time.
Right, is the check.
That is absolutely amazing that we went for like an hour and a half without saying goal, plan, do check. I don't even know how it happened. Yeah.
Goal, plan, do check. All right. We got
goal,
it.
Goal, plan, do check.
Sounds good. Laura, Helen, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to staying in touch with you all and watching the co-op approach continue to move forward. It's been a pleasure. All right. And that is going to wrap up this episode of the OT Schoolhouse podcast. I really hope you enjoyed learning a little bit more about the co-op approach. Thank you so much to Helen and to Laura for taking the time out of their day to spend about an hour, maybe even more, with me talking about the co-op approach. It's quite an amazing approach. It's very client-centered, and it really does help. As you heard from Helen and Laura, they are using it throughout their careers. And yeah, it's just something worth learning more about. You can learn more about the co-op approach for yourself at icancoop.org. Or if you're also interested, check out the OT Schoolhouse Back to School Conference at otschoolhouse.com/conference, where Laura is actually going to be presenting about the principles of the co-op approach in school-based OT. Until next time, take care. Have a great rest of your day, your week, and your month. And yeah, I hope to see you in the next episode of the OT Schoolhouse Podcast. Take care. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the OT Schoolhouse Podcast. For more ways to help you and your students succeed right now, head on over to otschoolhouse.com. Until next time, class is dismissed.